Hello, and welcome to episode 166 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Somewhat Mellow Autumn Readies Tons of Shows.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, Tonza, T-O-N-Z-A, Tonza. I am your host, Julia Guglia of internet fame, a Dash podcaster, and with me, as always, is Trevor, a.k.a. Rutiger Q Podcaster.
Hello.
Hiya. Got some news?
Yes, I do.
Oh, boy.
So, a little bit of news. Mm-hmm. So, the Birds of Prey movie has found two of its leads.
Do.
So, an actress I am not familiar with, Journey Smollett-Bell, who is an actress of color, will be playing Black Canary. We talked before, I don't think on the show, but I mentioned to you before that they were searching for someone a bit more diverse to play mm-hmm. Black Canary instead of just having the cast be all white people.
Yep.
And Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who you know, Ramona from Scott Pilgrim. She was in the most couple of recent Die Hard movies, and then she was in 10 Cloverfield Lane with John Goodman.
That
was her big starring role, I guess, in addition to Scott Pilgrim. We'll be playing Huntress.
That's cool. Nice.
And that's the only casting we have so far. So I guess at this point we're... And of course, Margot Robbie is Harley Quinn. So we're waiting mm-hmm. for... As is rumored, well, I don't think they're going to do Oracle because they're still trying to do a Batgirl movie. The rumors had it, you recall we talked about this,
yes.
The rumors had it, it would be the three of them and also featuring Renee Montoya and possibly Cassandra Cain, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So no casting on that yet, but we have Black Canary and Huntress at least. So the movie is definitely moving forward.
That's really great.
In TV news, we have the title of the CW crossover for this year. You know this already. It'll be called Elseworlds,
mm-hmm.
Which of course is the brand that DC used for, I don't know how long, 10 years, 15 years back after Crisis on Infinite Earths, when they're like, no, there's only one Earth, there are no alternate Earths anymore. But of course, creators wanted to tell out-of-continuity stories, so they devised the Elseworlds label and retroactively applied it to Batman Gotham by Gaslight, I think was the first one. Then eventually it was on everything from Kingdom Come to, I'm not sure they put it on New Frontier, just because New Frontier was like a prestige thing, but it basically applied to that. It was, you know, all the stuff, Red Sun, Superman mm-hmm. Red Sun. It was just sort of their way of getting around. Well, these aren't alternate parallel Earths in the multiverse. This is just, these are out of continuity Elseworlds. Like, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. But anyway, yeah. that was their thing for, you know, alternate realities. So they're going to be calling the crossover that. So it's leading me to believe that maybe Batwoman will exist on a different Earth
mm-hmm.
than Earth 1 and whatever Earth Supergirl is on. As a way of separating it. Because if the Elseworlds is referring to Earth 1 and Supergirl's Earth, why title it that? We've had multiple crossovers that feature those two Earths. That's not
right.
That's not what makes this special. We also have a new character that's being added for this crossover. The actor I'm not familiar with, but he's going to be playing the character of the Monitor, which is super cool because in Crisis on Infinite Earths, the Monitor was the all-knowing, all-seeing sort of guardian of the multiverse, so to speak, that gathered all the heroes together to fight the Anti-Monitor,
mm-hmm.
his evil counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that they're establishing the Monitor here, I guess they're going to set him up. Maybe they'll do it's the way that they named him in the press release. They gave him like a name that sounds like when Grant Morrison came in to do Final Crisis, he established that there were a whole race of Monitors, and the first Monitor was named Dax Novu and all this stuff, and then he became the Monitor we know or something, and then there was an other Monitor who fell, Mandrake, and he became like this dark vampiric Monitor and all this other stuff. So I'm not sure if they're going to be tapping into that and having there be a race of Monitors or whether they're just going to have it be one Monitor. It was kind of cool what Morrison did, actually. He had to be 52 Monitors, one overseeing each Earth. And they kind of reflected the Earth that they were monitoring. I'm not quite sure which direction that flowed, like whether their presence affected the Earth's development or whether the Earth sort of affected the Monitor's personality or whatever. But you had, you know, like a Monitor would, like there would be a female Monitor overlooking the Earth that had, where all the heroes were female, and you would mm-hmm. have, you know, like, and it's not like there was a Monitor with a cowboy hat overseeing the Justice Riders Earth or whatever, but there were subtle ways in which they sort of reflected the Earth they were monitoring.
What about the Monitor of the Earth that didn't have any life on it?
I don't remember what deal with that was. I think they, I'm trying to
remember.
Or
the one that reigned over the Earth of Bunnies.
Yeah, I think there was like a rabbit Monitor, like an animal
cool.
Monitor. I can't remember. Anyway, but I think when that
I shudder to think of what Earth X's Monitor.
I think there was a whole
like.
Thing like when that one Earth was destroyed, the Monitors had to figure out what to do with that Monitor. Like he was punished for failing his world or something, and he went rogue. I'm trying to remember. All this was not in Final Crisis,
a Ronin Monitor,
but was in sort of a spin-off/prequel series called countdown to Final Crisis, which wasn't very good, even though Paul Dini worked on it a little bit. So a lot of that I'm kind of blocking out of my memory. Mm. But anyway, it's cool that the monitor will be in there. I wonder if they're setting him up now, even if he doesn't play a huge role in this story, with the thought that maybe down the line they might actually do something like the Crisis.
Yeah.
I mean, they have set that up since the very first episode of The Flash. Like, there's that newspaper from 2024 or whatever that says Flash missing, vanishes in crisis by Iris West Allen, right? Whoa. So they've set that up. I don't know if these shows are going to run for another six years, but, you know, they did set up that there is possibly a crisis in the future for these characters. So I don't know. I don't think they have some big 10-year plan for all these shows, but that would be a little idealistic, a little, you know what I mean?
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
Even if some of these shows are still around in some form, like a spinoff of a spinoff of a spinoff, I don't think The Flash will still be running, no pun intended, in 6 years. So I'm not sure what they would do with that. But anyway, it's kind of cool that they're putting the monitor in there. And then this just came out today, a little bit of Star Trek Discovery news. We knew that it was returning in early 2019 for season two, but we have a hard date now. It's returning in January, so pretty much as early 2019 as possible. And of course, as we record this, we're only a few days away from the debut of the Short Treks minisodes, the first of which we'll be able to talk about next week. Those start on October 4th, so Thursday.
Yep.
And so those will go for all of October, and then we'll have a couple of months with nothing, and then the show itself will return in January. They also unveiled a new poster, which is pretty cool looking. It shows like these red anomalies that, if you've seen the trailer, are this mysterious thing that Spock disappeared to investigate, and now the others are trying to find Spock. And it's like these red anomalies, and they sort of form the shape of the Starfleet insignia. It's sort of, you know, if you look at it for a second, it's pretty cool, but it doesn't really reveal much that we didn't already know. Were you gonna say something?
My question was, what other shows are coming back? We should probably tell our viewers
why don't we finish when we go through our regular stuff, and then when we're signing off, we'll talk about what's coming up.
Okay,
what the schedule is. And so the last bit of news this week, which you also know, is that DC and Sean Murphy have announced a sequel to his acclaimed Batman White Knight.
Yes.
Miniseries. So Batman Curse of the White Knight will debut sometime in 2019. We talked before about how it was so popular that they're basically saying, just do more.
Yep.
You know, create your own little side universe here with spinoffs.
You are more than welcome. Yeah, yeah.
So they're retroactively brand, much like it's kind of history repeating itself. Actually, you had Batman Gotham by Gaslight, which was Mike Mignola's, who later went on to create Hellboy, first big project that he helmed. Like, he'd done art for DC before. He did Cosmic Odyssey and a few things. I'm not sure if that was before or after, but it was his big sort of quote-unquote vanity project. I don't mean that in a, you know, negative sort. For DC was Gotham by Gaslight, and then the other things that it spawned, like I said earlier, ended up being retroactively labeled Elseworlds.
Yeah.
And now you've got Sean Murphy with a sort of a boundary-breaking Batman story that proved to be so popular that now that DC has this Black Label imprint, and they're doing more stuff like Batman Damned and stuff like that, now they're retroactively applying that label to Batman White Knight and making it the first Black Label book. So even though they're going back even further and branding books that used to be Elseworlds, like Kingdom Come, are now going to be called Black Label. So, one input must die before another can live, I suppose. But there's sort of a
history repeating
itself here of a creator driven Batman project sort of launching a new sort of more mature line of graphic novels that DC then was like, oh yeah, you know what, we'll just say that was the first, always planned to be the first in the new line.
So that'll swirl mustache here. Yes.
Sometime in 2019, the blurb hints that we'll get more exploration of, you recall there was that whole thread in Batman White Knight that the Wayne family had like dealings with Nazi weapons manufacturers, and it also has to do with Mr. Freeze's family. So the Joker is going to try to bring some of that to light and attempt to discredit Batman, and Batman's going to have to go on this quest to, you know, clear his family name and stuff. And it's also going to introduce Azrael into this universe. So I think Sean Murphy said that while the first book was sort of Joker's rise, and then I guess by the end kind of fall again, and Batman made all these mistakes, and the whole one of the themes of the series was about Batman realizing like he has to do something a little differently, he has to change a little bit. This one is going to be more of like Batman's redemption, so it's going to be him trying to get back to where he should be after being brought low by the events of the first book. I'm looking forward to that next year.
Me too.
The format will probably be different. If it's going to be Black Label, I suspect instead of being like 7 or 8 monthly issues of regular size, it might be more like Batman Damned, where we might get like slightly different trim size, perhaps, and then like 3 or 4 extra sized issues
Yep.
That they can sort of put the nice square binding on and, you know, have in bookstores is like book one, book two, and book three instead of, you know, just floppy, six or seven floppy issues that are sold in the direct market. So we'll see, but I would suspect something like that. And we don't really have much more details on it yet other than the art that you've seen, which is the promo art that shows Azrael on there and that little plot
blur. Looks like it's by the same artist that did White Knight. So yeah. I was just wondering to make sure.
Yeah, he's got it made if he keeps making these.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so I imagine what they'll probably do is maybe they'll do like, he'll do a trilogy of these books and then maybe they'll have other creators come on and do like little side stories and spinoffs and stuff. But I think he's, once the first one proved to be successful, I think that he sort of started in his mind plotting out sort of an arc.
Like, I have ideas for part two. Yeah.
And that's it for our news.
Wow. Good bit of news.
So now, what was your comic of the week?
Oh, this week I chose Justice League Dark. It surprised me. It was actually one of the last ones that we read this week, but it stuck with me long after I'd read everything else, and I really enjoyed it. The events were surprising. The character that came out of the dark wherever was really, really chilling. The snake-like dude with no eyes. He's like anatomically kind of correct, but not really.
Well, he's the upside down man. So he's standing, even when he's not standing on anything, he is upside down.
Yeah.
But his mouth looks to us to be right side up.
Yeah.
So it looks like he's smiling always, and his mouth is like correct from our perspective, but from his perspective, it would be upside down or something because he like put himself together wrong because he doesn't understand our corporeal forms.
Yeah, it's creepy. Also, I love the beginning parts that went into Zatanna's background, because the first page itself was really beautiful, and you pointed out the symmetry to me, but I noticed it too. It was her daily practice and her daily regimen that her father bestowed on her and made her keep. Sometimes he would use magic to wake her up and then get her into training mode, and she first started learning all the magic tricks as magic tricks, but then actually started using intention and the inner magic, like the true magic, not illusions, but actual magic, to do the same tricks and evolve as not just a performer, but an actual magician, like an actual sorceress. Would she be labeled one? I think, what is she typically labeled as?
I mean, I guess she's both.
Yes, definitely. I mean, she's a performer from that standpoint, but also a person who wields real magic. So getting into her backstory and looking at the art and how it was presented was really interesting, and how involved it is, because the intention of magic is important, but also there are limitations because of who and what we are, that the people who wield magic have to be consigned to certain limitations so that their bodies don't basically explode with the raw power of it, and also so they don't get noticed by creatures like the Upside Down Man. So that's a nice chilling sort of consequence that I never thought about. I always thought, oh, hey, it's just magic. It's just, you know, this energy that some people can wield, and there's no cost associated with it, and there's no penalty for using it, but there is. And she, like, the way it was written was really nice, because there was that extra level added to her story that I'd never considered before.
And then the implications for Wonder Woman, too.
That was stunning. She has some
sort of dark magical
But was it dark or was it light? Because it literally blasted away. It was a counter energy to the, and it was, I mean, it was drawn white. It was drawn as a blinding, searing light, and the dark energy was dispelled by it. And it was drawn as something that her body could barely contain. But it really seemed like a counter force. The one thing that could wield, that one could wield against dark is light. And so it was nicely portrayed, and it was also pretty awesome, because I love Wonder Woman, and I love the history of it, and there are a few people who do something interesting with the character that's kind of new. Like, Brian Azzarello's run was really interesting, but also the run that we read after that, where she had a bout of, I don't want to say insanity, but there was a snake that bit her, and
well, that was the was yeah sort of the Greg Rucka rebirth yes. run where she discovered that her origin wasn't in fact the Brian Azzarella. So you're saying my two favorite runs were the Brian Azzarella run, and then yeah. the run that negated the Brian Azzarella
pretty
run.
Pretty much,
but that's fine. I mean, that's being a DC Comics fan is accepting contradictory information in an Orwellian way. Like you can like the thing, and then you can also like the thing.
Greg Rucka is good at including. Yeah, he's good at including things that other people have done. So yeah. he doesn't.
That was done
anything,
in a fairly elegant way. Like, all that yeah. stuff still happened. It's right. just that it wasn't the real Themyscira or the real gods, but she still experienced
it. It was
those
an
things.
Illusion thing that she experienced.
Or, like,
yeah.
people pretending to be the people she thought they were or whatever. I don't think it's really ever going to be super clear because I don't think they want to dwell on that too much.
I'm just saying, yes. like, there's a certain identity, back to what I was saying, is that there's a certain identity through those stories that you get to know the character. And I'm not speaking as any kind of expert because of her 75-year history or whatever. I've only started reading comics for, what, 2 years? Three? So, I'm in no way an expert, but I do feel the same kinship and ownership, sort of the character. And I'm torn sometimes when people try to do something new and it sort of fails because it goes against what I feel the character is. Like, I've spoken about examples like that before. But in this case, it's so refreshing to see something add a depth to her character, do something new with her character, but something that doesn't go against the grain of the core of who she is.
Well, that's what James Tynion said that he wants to do with this series, which is Wonder Woman, when you think about it, has always had somewhat of a magical
yes.
origin, mm-hmm. especially before she was the daughter of Zeus and she was sort of magically imbued with life from clay.
Right.
But that's never really been... She's never really been a character that walks in like the magic side of the DC universe with characters like Constantine and right. Zatanna and stuff like that. So he says, well, why not? Like, let's take her out of her element mm-hmm. and thrust her into this world and moreover show that she has a connection to this world yeah. that she's never really realized yep. and that'll let them do something different with her.
Yeah.
So I think that was a good idea. And having her there, I mean, it helps sell the book too.
Yeah.
So if it was just Detective Chimp, Zatanna, yeah. and Man-Bat. I'm
well,
not
come
sure.
on, Constantine would sell
but
books.
But he's not a member, though. He just showed up for this first arc
okay,
to,
fair.
Because, you know, he led the previous iteration of the yeah. team. And when
something
huge
Swamp
is
Thing.
Going on.
Swamp Thing was on the cover,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Swamp Thing might be more popular after his TV show, but I'm not sure right now Swamp Thing would be... He would be, like, the name character, I suppose, mm-hmm. if it was just him, Detective Chimp, Man-Bat, and Zatanna.
yeah.
But I don't think that book would last for very long, and, you know, without someone like Wonder Woman, who's, like, arguably DC's most visible character right now in the... As the head.
Yeah.
So,
One last thing I'll mention about it is the art, the way it was laid out. Specifically, I'm thinking about the page. I mean, everything was beautiful and her exploding and banishing the light, the upside down man, you know, screaming away and the chilling portrayal of that character in general was awesome. But I'm talking really about the following panel where everything gets put right. Where Swamp Thing comes back from being dried out, Detective Chimp is no longer in a liquid form, and the layout of that and the over the background of this searing light doing right by the world. It was really nicely arranged, and you could read it left to right, you know, and the progression of each character being reassembled into what they were supposed to look like in the first place, and the resolution of that was just beautiful. I really dug that particular page. That would be my spread of the week, not panel, because there were multiple panels in that two-page spread, right? But yeah, it was glorious. It was great.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's why I picked it for my comic of the week. What did you choose?
So I might have picked that, which is crazy in a week that had a new series from Tom King and Heroes in Crisis and an issue of Doomsday Clock. So I might have picked that, but I knew you were going to pick it, so I didn't mind just... I don't want to always pick what you're going to pick. So I went with Doomsday Clock.
Nice.
I enjoyed Heroes in Crisis. I enjoyed Heroes in Crisis a lot too, but as a first issue, I feel like it didn't bowl me over. It was mostly set up, and also I'm a little salty that it seems like they killed Wally West, even though I don't think that's going to last for more than a year, if that. But it still bugs me a little bit when they do that. Like, I understand why you want to, you know, get readers emotionally invested by having tragedy befall one of their beloved characters mm-hmm. and so on. But at this
what
point...
What about boy Roy Harper? Come on now.
Yeah, but see, the thing
I
is...
I love Roy and his arc.
I really like him too, but I kind of... I'm going to miss him less, and B, I feel like Wally has been so central to the whole rebirth
yeah.
arc that I find it hard to believe that... before this whole thing with the missing years and everything is over, they're just going to take him off the stage.
Yeah.
Like, I don't buy that. So that sort of, like, I always had that in my back of the back of my head while I was reading it. And that sort of took me out of it a little bit. So it's nobody's fault. It doesn't reflect on the quality of the issue. It was just my own little, you know, metatextual, you know, being aware of the real world while I was reading the comic thing. So I went with Doomsday Clock, which is always excellent. And in this issue, I felt a lot of, the issues are always good, but it's definitely a slow story, as Watchmen was too in its own way. But I feel like this issue really kicked it up, because here we finally get Dr. Manhattan showing up and the characters asking him the questions that we, the readers, have been asking. We get information about, you know, what happened, why there is no Justice Society, why he's been messing with the DC Universe, you know, how long he's been there, and the idea that he's had this vision, that he did all this because he had this vision of the Earth in ruins and Superman coming at him, and then past that, he couldn't see anything, even though he can see all times at all time, at least within the parameters of his own existence, which means that either, I guess, the existence ends at that point, or he does. And because he saw that, I guess he decided to, like, we're still not working with a complete set of information, but it seems like based on that, he decided to change things a little bit, like, to see if he can avert that outcome. And so he, like, it was killing me reading it, because I love the Justice Society characters, and I love Alan Scott and Jay Garrick and those characters who created those legacies. And so the way Johns wrote it,
yeah,
just gave it. If he'd shown up and disintegrated Alan Scott, it wouldn't have had the same pathos as, oh, he moved the lantern just like 6 inches out of his reach,
yep,
so that the train derailment that he originally got his powers in instead killed him, and there was no Justice Society. And this description of Dr. Manhattan walking through an empty meeting hall and stroking his finger along the dust of the table that would have had all the Justice Society members meeting around it. And you remember all the stories of all the members sitting around the big table that all superhero teams have and having their meetings. Like, the idea that all that has just been
wiped away with robbed one little from the tiny universe move.
Yeah. Because of his capricious whim and his desire to experiment. Just like, it made me, like, viscerally angry at the character in the way that I don't normally, like, get riled up by villains. Like, even when a villain kills a character I like whoever killed Wally West in Heroes in Crisis.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'm going to be, I'm like, oh, it turned out to be that person. Like, I'm sure it'll be a good story, but I don't think I'm going to be viscerally angry at that character and want to see them taken down, because I've just been around the block too many times.
Yeah.
But after so long of the Justice Society being, because there's been no Justice Society with the exception of the Earth 2 book, which was pretty good, but there's been no, like, classic recognizable main Earth Justice Society since the New 52 started 7 or 8 years ago. That's a long time to be without the characters that basically founded the DC universe, like the first super team in literature, basically.
Yeah.
I've heard people write about this. So, like, the only possible precedent would be, like, the Knights of the Round Table, but they weren't really a superhero team. But the idea that you had multiple fictional characters, you know, forming a group, coming from their own adventures and then dispersing, wasn't something that had ever really been done before the Justice Society.
Yeah.
And so it's you know, it's important. And it's been gone. And his machinations and the way they were described here really, really got to me. And then
I think it was his callousness that got to you too.
Well, yeah, but I'm used to that from him.
Yeah.
But he was actually more convivial than I thought he was going to be. Like, Ozymandias and Rorschach are like, we've got questions for you, John. Yeah. And he's like, okay, ask your questions. Like, let me take you to Mars and then let me put you in, like, this black and white theater where they're showing those crime dramas that I still don't quite understand why they keep coming back to.
Yeah.
I mean, he kind of linked it, Manhattan kind of linked it thematically here to what he's going through, but I still think there's got to be more to why they spent pages and pages of these books talking about this old series of black and white crime movies. Anyway, and all the stuff with Joker and Batman was interesting. You know, Rorschach, we discover Ozymandias isn't really dying. Rorschach is kind of disillusioned.
Yep.
All the stuff with Johnny Thunder and Saturn Girl are there. The fact that Saturn Girl is there, I feel like she's kind of there. John's kind of put her there. First of all, he loves the Legion. He's using this to kind of bring the Legion back in a way. But I feel like Saturn Girl is kind of there to reassure the longtime DC readers that all this is going to turn out okay. She's like, don't worry, Johnny, you'll get your genie back, you'll get the lantern back. She's going to be like, don't worry, readers, the Justice Society is coming back, regardless of how dark things seem now. You know? She comes from a future where all this worked out and everybody's back, you know? So I feel like she's kind of there as a bit of an audience surrogate character.
Okay, but then remember the part where she said, wait, this wasn't supposed to happen. Wait, what's happening now? This wasn't supposed to happen.
Well,
Because there was a moment in that where she started out like a Pollyanna. Like, don't worry, I've already been on the other side of this future. It's fine.
I don't recall her specifically. I mean, she's always going to be working from incomplete information. Like, she might know that eventually, in the early 20th century, the Justice Society returned. But she wouldn't know necessarily that, oh, Ozymandias is going to betray these people and knock out Johnny Thunder and take the Owl ship and do X, Y, and Z and punch me. And, you know, history books wouldn't record that information. So she might know that everything turns out okay, but she might still be surprised by the beat-to-beat developments in the story. If she was like, oh no, this history said that this never happened and things happened differently, I don't remember that moment. You could be right, but I still think that, I think that she's probably going to have a bit of a rude awakening at some point in the story, just because that's going to be an arc for her.
Yeah.
But I still feel like she's supposed to be there for us to know that if the Legion still exists in the future, things can't get too bad, you know?
Yeah.
And Johns isn't going to write a story where things go so badly that the Legion never exists in the future. Like, he's here to, you know, one of the reasons he's doing this is to bring the JSA and the Legion back into continuity. So I enjoyed that. And I just want to give so I mentioned Heroes in Crisis, but I also really enjoyed the first issue of Justice League Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Stepan Sedgwick art, you know, we talked about him on Aquaman all the time. It's really good. It was a really good story too. The idea of teaming up Cyborg and Starfire and Azrael and Jessica Cruz and Darkseid.
Yeah.
It's like a real interesting mixture of characters, and they all kind of have their own reasons to be there. And the idea that they are like worshipped as ancient gods by these different cultures in the ghost sector because of something they're going to do in the future.
Yeah.
You know? It's a really interesting setup, really interesting first issue. I feel like between Justice League Dark, and Justice League Odyssey, mm-hmm. we've really got an interesting mix of titles. And they're each sort of exploring a different area of the DC universe and expanding it. Like, Justice League is all about introducing these new forces, like the ultraviolet spectrum and the still force and stuff like that, and expanding what's beyond the source wall and what is the totality and all that stuff. Then you've got Justice League Dark revealing new stuff about how magic works in the DC universe and where it came from. And then you've got Justice League Odyssey exploring the outer space stuff and this new ghost sector of sort of classic returning planets like Tamaran and new alien races that can be introduced, and putting Darkseid in there to add an extra cosmic element. So I feel like they've kind of got that covered now. And then there's all sorts of other books, I guess, that deal with the more street level stuff, like, you know, we've got a new Outsiders book coming and stuff like that. But I feel like they've sort of covered the spread there.
They have they have done that.
So that's it for our books. You want to talk about you want me to give you your pop quiz?
I am ready.
Okay, so this week at your suggestion, I'm going to be quizzing you about season 2 of Star Trek Enterprise.
Oh man, I crack one joke.
I actually think that this might be one of the easier ones I've given you, but we'll see what you think. Maybe now that I've said that, it's...
Yeah, I'm raising my eyebrows. Yeah.
All right, number one.
Yes?
What is the name of the future temporal agent who posed as a member of Archer's crew?
Oh, that guy. Well, I can describe his face in great detail. Let's see. Williams.
Wilkinson. He was literally in an episode that we watched yesterday.
I know, but I can't remember his name. It either starts with an M or a W, but I can't remember.
No, neither of those is true.
Really?
His name was Daniels.
Daniels.
You're fairly close when you said Williams. I could tell you were sort of in the right
area. I don't know. It just has that same timbre. Anyway.
All right, number two.
Yes.
What invention in the mid-20th century was actually devised by Vulcans?
Mid-20th century invention. What? I mean, that could be any number of things. It could be a food, whatever the processor is, what you call it? The replicator?
Yeah, but humanity didn't start using replicators in the mid-20th century.
Well, how did they get their Rock to Geno? I mean, the other one. Coffee Black.
Hmm?
They replicate stuff in the 20th century.
In the 20th century?
Oh, no. Yeah, no. No, how would I know that? I don't know.
Velcro, remember?
Oh, you! That's hilarious. Okay.
You remember that, right?
I do remember that.
Okay. You're the mid-20th century. I mean, there's only been one Enterprise episode that took place in the mid-20th century.
Yeah, okay. Ha ha.
All right, number three.
Mm-hmm.
What alien race constructed the minefield that threatened Enterprise?
What?
What alien race constructed the minefield?
Are you talking about Next Gen now?
No.
Are you talking about Deep Space Nine?
No.
There are lots of minefields in Star Trek.
There's been at least two. I'll grant you that.
What minefield are you talking about? Are you talking about one on ground or in space?
In space. Okay. The episode was literally called Minefield.
I don't remember this.
And Archer and Reed had to go out onto the hull of the ship to defuse a mine that it had fixed itself, and it sort of pierced his leg with one of its
Oh, was it the Suliban that put it there?
No. You give up?
Yeah.
It was the Romulans. It was the first time we heard mentioned. Oh. Well, I guess technically Archer read the word Romulan in a book in the season premiere, but that was right. The first time that actually had any contact with the Romulans.
No, I forgot about that. I thought, because it was the Suliban that were gaining on them, and so they had to move while trying to deactivate this thing.
No, the Romulans. The Romulans were threatening to attack them unless they left their territory. The Suliban weren't in that episode.
Oh, wow. I'm not remembering this at all. I think you're just confused because
they both kind of use cloaking technology.
Yeah.
All right, number four.
Mm-hmm.
What piece of technology did Malcolm Reed accidentally leave on a pre-warp planet?
He left his communicator.
Correct.
Yay, finally I got one.
All right, number five.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the crew forced to take refuge while Enterprise passed through a deadly radiation belt?
Ooh, in the nacelles.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll give it to you, but specifically what part of the...
Well, the catwalk?
The catwalk, yeah. Like, the episode was literally called Catwalk.
In the catwalk.
Number six.
Uh-huh.
What practice among Vulcans is stigmatized during the time period of the show?
Mind melds.
Correct. All right, number seven. Where is Archer sent to serve a life sentence for crimes against the Klingon Empire?
Oh, the icy jail that we saw Kirk and Spock escape from that right. time. The ice planet jail.
Right, which was called... Actually, I think it's a moon.
Yeah, it's a whole moon. That's got a mining colony.
What do they mine there? For half credit, what do they mine there?
Deuterium?
Dilithium?
Dilithium. Okay, yeah.
And the name of the moon is called?
Something with an R?
Yeah, Rurapente.
Rurapente.
All right, number eight.
You will repente.
Among the Visian species,
uh-huh.
Among the Visian species, what term is used for members of their third gender?
Oh, cogenitor.
Correct.
Yay.
So you got one, two, three.
I got four.
Four.
Yay.
Yeah. Pretty good.
Not so bad. Ask me the first few again. I'll get them right this time.
Possibly.
Possibly. That's right. I remember Daniels now, but the other three I don't remember.
And that's it for the show.
Oh, that was a fun show. Thanks for the quiz.
Sure. So we should talk about what's coming up.
Yes.
So next week we will have the first Short Treks minisode. And probably by the time we record, we'll also have seen the season premiere of Doctor Who. And then, if I'm not mistaken, next week after we record, the CW shows start coming back. I'm not sure if they all start in the same week or not. I want to say Flash starts first next week. I could be wrong about that. But at any rate, next week we'll have a couple of shows to talk about. And then going forward, the CW shows will all start again. And of course, Gotham and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. are being held back till... later in the year, because Gotham is doing a half season for its final right. season, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't premiering until next summer.
Whoa, that's a long time.
So those are going to be a while, but Black Lightning, Legends, Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, those will all be back. I don't know when Krypton's coming back. I don't think Sci-Fi has officially announced it yet.
I'm all about The Good Place, so we can maybe add that to our roster.
I'm not sure we'd necessarily be talking about that on this show, though.
I know.
And,
it's a good show, though.
And Runaways, I saw Runaways just had the first trailer for its season two, so I think it's coming back in the next month or two also.
Do you think Hulu's going to do a big dump, or is it going to be weekly last time?
Well, I think their thing for a long time has been weekly, but I just heard on a podcast that they did some new show where they did release it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're experimenting with their release schedule, so mm-hmm. I don't know. But, I mean,
if it did
well enough to justify a season two, so I would have to think they're probably not going to monkey with Runaways' release schedule, since obviously it worked for them. They might be experimenting with a more accelerated release schedule for different shows, maybe shows that have fewer episodes. Like, if it's a 4-episode or 5-episode short series, then maybe release them all at once so people can binge them like a long movie. But I'd be surprised if they changed the schedule for Runaways.
Yeah. Oh, well. Well, that's... a lot to look forward to at any rate. So if you want to reach out to us, we have an email address, mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. On Twitter, we are @smartspodcast. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. How about a funny sound for us?
I don't have one.
How about on the catwalk?